sent to. And then, as a prisoner, he was secret city, sort of gulag, but he was in many gulags, were making advantage of them. So, as before the Second World War, in 1945, he was German V2F. His life, freedom after the death in 1954 of Stalin, to German and to exile.
Well, that's an interesting opinion on a guy who's not IDing himself. Leslie, unfortunately, someone is testing out their radio equipment by transmitting intermittently while you're talking. So about half of what you said was completely silent. I'm sorry.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Basically saying that Korolev was political for a while, got himself locked up in the gulag for quite a few years, and eventually got out and eventually became part of the movement in Russia. I'm sure I left out a lot, but, you know, basically that's what he's saying. Back to you.
Okay, thank you very much, Paul. To me, it kind of brings to mind, it's probably not exactly relevant, but there was this interesting thing that we had called Operation Paperclip after World War II. Basically, we grabbed every smart German scientist we could find. The guy at NASA who basically made NASA work, von Braun, being number one, but there were a lot of other guys of dubious history who got a pass because they were useful. Scattered all over the darn place, those ex-Nazi guys. So I am always reminded of good old Operation Paperclip. Well, we all show that throw enough money at us and we'll let anything ride. Anyway, with that in mind, I don't want to delay anymore. I hope Jim is still with us and has a question. So Jim, KD2VHD, are you still there and do you still have a question?
I'm still here and I do have a question. It's been refined through the mill of the last hour.
Okay, please share with us.
On space and the moon and Operation Paperclip and et cetera, et cetera. I'll ask this. What is going on at the south pole of the moon? Shackleton Crater, very strange. The Chinese have a rover heading that direction, if I understand it correctly. We have an Operation Artemis that's supposed to be putting people over in that direction soon. Shackleton Crater looks completely artificial when you look at it in various images from multiple different types of imaging technologies. So what's going on up there?
Okay, I am not particularly a moon expert, so I'll ask Paul if he has anything to add to it. You have to be a little bit cautious about perception. The humanity has evolved through a method kind of called pattern recognition. Show us some vague thing, and we can kind of reconstruct what it might be. It has very good evolutionary tendencies because if you hear something that's not quite a saber-toothed tiger, but possibly one, and you get away from it before it eats you, you drive debris and have more human beings for pattern recognition. But sometimes we let pattern recognition get the best of us. We look at constellations that don't look at all like the drawings. If you ever see the drawings of the constellation, you need a very good imagination to see all kinds of things that everyone kind of takes for granted these days. People see things in clouds, and one of the big things was that crater in Mars that was supposed to be the face of Mars. And if you looked at it from different angles, it just looked like a rock. So sometimes things that appear to be one thing are not. But let me ask Paul if you know anything particularly about the Shackleton Crater and what everyone is racing there to do.
Okay, Roy. Yes, Shackleton Crater. Well, it's a big crater. It's very close, like you said, near the South Pole. And then there's another one. Oh, it begins with an N, November. Newton, I forget the N. I'll think of it. Anyway, that's very close to Shackleton Crater. And that's where they're going to land the NASA Viper mission. Viper is going to be an unmanned rover that's going to ride around and investigate where ice is and check out different kinds of minerals. Now, the reason... Now, yeah, again, China, and they want to go there, too. And if Russia ever sets up a base, they plan on doing that. Looks like they want to team up with China now. But, yeah, that's where we would set the base. That's where our first missions and, will, you know, the Artemis program will all go. The idea is that part of the moon tends to stay mostly in light. You know, if you're on the equator of the moon, you know, you're going to get, you know, 14 days of daylight, 14 days of nighttime. Those 14 days of nighttime are a struggle to keep any kind of equipment running, facilities for people to live in. You know, you really do need nuclear power, and it better be reliable. You can't lose your power on the equator area. But down south, and near the south pole of the moon, it tends to stay light longer. Let me drop it. No, you know, they actually have, like on the rim of the one crater where they want to put this Viper rover, when it gets dark there, yeah, the longest it'll be is a couple of days, like I think 3 days. So that you only need enough equipment to keep things, you know, going warm for those 3 days. The other days of the month, it's in daylight, so you could use a lot of solar panels to try to, you know, keep your power going, supplemented maybe with nuclear power, nuclear fission, maybe with fuel cells using hydrogen and oxygen. You know, you can really set up a base on the south pole of the moon because of the long daylight. That's just the orbital mechanics of the moon that allow that. So that's what's going on there. And also communications. Let me drop it. You know, of course, we'll be 24/7. They'll be able to, you know, put their beams toward Earth, and even when they, no matter what time of day or month, part of the month, they'll always be able to transmit to and from Earth at that location. And that's pretty much it. So Shackleton, and when his boat was shipwrecked in the South Pole, he didn't know he was going to be as famous as, you know, where they're going to name a crater after him, and maybe that'll be the first base sent up. That's always a good story, the Shackleton story, if you haven't read that, how everybody survives on that trip. Getting stuck in the ice. Back to you, Roy, WS2N.
Very good. I think the other crater is the Nobile crater. You know, taking a look at it, you know, I think at one point they thought that there was lunar ice, so that could be a good reason to try that site. I don't know what became of that thought process, but was Nobile what you were thinking?
Said Nobile. You're right. It escaped me. And it was in the news not too long ago, too, because of the Viper mission. But any of the cratered areas, because the cratered areas are dark 24/7, it doesn't matter, you know, for the last billion years, so you could have a lot of ice stuck in those craters that they could mine out and then dig that ice out, and of course make water, make oxygen, make hydrogen. You'll have oxygen to breathe, water to drink, oxygen to put into a spaceship, maybe hydrogen to put into the spaceship for fuel. They want to get that resource. Yeah, of course, that's the other main reason. Where you might not have any, you know, craters on the equator, are subjected to sunlight every now and then, the way the sun hits going straight down, so chances are you might not have the, you know, I'll call it perma-ice, frozen tundra, whatever you want to call it, in these dark craters. Yeah, you're right, Roy. Back to you.
Okay, very good. I don't know. I'm taking a look at the picture. It looks like a lot of craters, but it doesn't look particularly weird to me, Jim. In what way is it considered a group of craters?
Well, to me, it goes back to the childhood TV show. One of these things is not like the others. One of these things just doesn't belong. That crater looks like it was made by a machinist. I've never seen any other crater look like that.
When is that?
Shackleton.
Okay, I never thought. I'll look at it like again and see if I notice that. Interesting. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, I've never seen an artificial crater being made by machinery, so I don't know. To my eye, but I certainly do not consider myself a specialist at all, it did look like a crater. I'm sure there are different acceptable shapes depending upon the matrix material underneath and the material that collided with the moon and the ages of the collisions and all kinds of interesting things. So, I don't know. It doesn't ping my internal meters personally, but, if it pings yours, so be it.
If you dig into the NASA images, there's images that are done by radar and mass spectrometry and UV and all sorts of different bandwidths. And on all of them, it has, visual light, and all of them has a very distinct, it doesn't have that natural feel look to it that the rest of them do. Very strange.
So is the thought behind this that there's some kind of alien situation that's causing this, or is there another theory that what caused this unique appearance of this crater?
I don't have a theory. I got a question. Theory takes a lot more information to come up with a thesis.
Okay. That's true. I don't know what to tell you. I never really thought that much, contemplated Shackleton that much. I've just forced in the past of my own personal beliefs of alien sentient life. I think that life is relatively, given billions of years, going to happen all over the universe. I think there's nothing particularly special about sentient life. It takes a lot longer. Evolution doesn't inherently drive everything to sentience, but I think there is sentient life outside of this world. But the universe, as they say, is a really, 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 really big place. It takes very, 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 very long time to get almost anywhere. So chances are all the sentient aliens are numerous light years away from us, and if we traveled as fast as we could, we would never live to reach them and vice versa. But I could be totally wrong, and there could be an alien sitting in a room someplace in Brooklyn listening to this transmission.
Interesting. Well, thanks for entertaining my question. Have a good evening. Good job, Roy.
Thank you, Jim. Let me bring out my mini puzzle first. I kind of like things where either people have taken them for granted or made assumptions. So this is kind of a nice one. Probably very short. Probably won't get past one or two comments. But tonight's little mini micro puzzle is if any of you have hazarded a look at the two-pronged AC plug that you use all the time to plug into the wall. Most of the time, you will notice that each of the blades has a circular hole driven through it. So my question for tonight among my listeners, if you would please, what the heck, why do AC two-bladed plugs have those holes in that particular position?
WB2GX,
yes, Rich.
The original specifications called for those holes, and they were never changed, even though there's no reason for them now.
Well, there sort of is a reason still. It's not a universal reason, but I have seen it demonstrated that there are some places that utilize that hole. Once again, anyone to hazard a guess of if there was a practical reason for your electrical outlet plugs having a hole in them, what it might be?
KD2VHD, I have the answer.
Okay, Jim?
The holes in the outlet plugs are a model of the Shackleton crater.
Yes, indeed. This is... this is a secret that people find out that I've broken that to the world. My life isn't worth anything. So I thank you for outing me and endangering my life, Jim. But nevertheless, if there was another reason why receptacles, and almost every receptacle you look at has those darn holes in them. Now, a few don't, but the overwhelming majority do. And, you know, we use these things every day. And I just wonder how many of you guys out there and gals took a look at that and say, gosh, I wonder what the damn holes are for.
Y2A?
Yes, Tony.
I actually know the answer to that. It's it's just a manufacturing aid, really. And it's not required, but actually the NEC specifies if they're going to use it, where it has to fall, because it doesn't. Can't interfere with the contact inside the receptacle, but it's there part of the manufacture. It's there as part of the manufacturing process. It serves no practical purpose, or it's not there for any practical purpose in terms of the end user.
Right, you are. Give yourself a gold star. It's in the NEMA standards. So if you do a Google search for NEMA, you will have the design with the exact dimensions of the blade and where the holes are placed, as Tony mentioned, because you have to be able to depend upon that so that the other side, the outlet, will not put pressure on a portion of the blade where the hole is and limit the turret carrying capacity. It was first designed purely for the manufacturers. There are still manufacturers who plug this way. They line up the blade and solder the connection and put it into a mold plastic and press the plastic to give you the plastic head of the outlet. And they use a positioning rod to maintain the blades at the proper angle and such. So yeah, it's purely for manufacturing purposes. It has nothing at all to do with usage. If anything, it's slightly detrimental if the manufacturer of the outlet itself designs a very poorly designed one. So thank you very much, Tony.
A friend of mine used to work for Leviton. That's the only reason I know. I asked him and he told me.
Okay, that's a good reason. Even also Google it. Some people, if you just ask the average person, sometimes they'll sort of tell you that there's some kind of mechanism inside the outlet that allows it to clamp onto the opening. And there's actually a YouTube I'll put up on my link page where the guy took the trouble of breaking outlets just to show that there's no such thing going on there. Obviously, guys in Leviton would kind of know that without thinking. So very good. Any other comments on this before we go to something completely different?
Sorry to use you as my victim for comedy, Roy.
Well, if you don't laugh, you cry, as the old saying goes. Okay, I'm going to try something. It probably will not work this week, but I'll, I'm kind of doing it to prime the pump for, say, maybe next Sunday. Andy, WA2CBL, returned from Mirfest, and he told me that an electrical engineer friend of his drew something on a napkin and offered it to him as a puzzle to be solved. And he was kind enough to send me a copy of that napkin, and I have put it on my link page, roy.at2ts.com. It's basically a curious circuit. It has a 1-volt battery at one end. There's a serial connection of a 1-ohm resistor. It goes into a 3-connector watt meter, which then serially goes into a amp meter with a parallel connected voltmeter. And then there's a mystery black box at the very end of the circuit. And supposedly the amp meter is 5 amps, the voltmeter is reading 5 volts, but the 3-connector watt meter is reading 0 watts. So the question the electrical engineer gave to Andy, and the one that I'm offering you people, is what the heck is in that black box that could give you a watt meter reading of 0 watts, yet give you an amperage of 0.5 amps and a voltage of 0.5 volts. Anyone want to take this up tonight?
A question?
Yes.
Yes, it's WA2ZDH. So you're saying that there's a half volt across this black box and a half amp going through this black box?
Yep. Yes, Ed.
Can you give me that address again? I want to look up the schematic.
Yes, it is, you type into your browser, Roy, Romeo Oscar Yankee, .ac2gs, that's my call sign, Alpha Charlie 2 Gulf Sierra, .com.
Will you ask 200 questions?
Yes, Paul. Yes, Paul.
I lost Roy.
You don't hear me?
WS2N with a question.
Well, I'm trying to send. It looks like I'm sending. Does anyone else not... Well, does anyone hear me out there?
I hear both of you.
Now I hear you. Before I heard nothing.
Oh, I don't know. I have the same signal coming out. Maybe it's probably, the link is very wonky lately, so there might be something going on with Glen Oaks and Selden's link. You wanted to say something?
How come the watt meter's got 3 connections, you know? That's throwing me off right there.
Well, here I get somewhat confused, because the way it was described to Andy was that it was a thermocoupled watt meter with 3 connectors. I'm not familiar with that type of a mechanism. I believe what I've heard is thermocoupled watt meters have 2 connections. Some watt meters have 3 terminals because they're both taking a reading of the real current that's going through and the parallel of voltage potential, and then doing a calculation in the meter block.
Okay, I never saw that. Back to you, Roy.
VDH with a question?
Yes, John.
Are these analog meters?
Well, unfortunately, from the schematic, they didn't mention it. I think that the story is that this is a guy in his 60s, the electrical engineer, who got this question in his college or graduate level PE courses. So at that point, I don't think there were that many digital meters. So let's make the assumption they're mechanical.
Well, if that black box has some kind of switch that periodically closes and opens with a 50% duty cycle, it'll have zero voltage, of course, when there's current flow, and zero current when there's voltage, of course. And that might make the inertial meters, the mechanical meters, free current, and yet there'd be no power.
Okay, that's interesting. I'm still, I mean, maybe you know more than me, but certainly you do. Thermocouple watt meters, aren't those sort of by definition a connection, not three?
Well, the watt meters I've seen, as you said, they usually have a voltage coil, a current coil, and then a common connection. Thermocouple watt meters, I've only seen those up around for RF stuff, or for reading RF current stuff, but I haven't seen a thermocouple watt meter. Okay.
Limar TechNet tonight at 8 o'clock. This is the W...
Okay, Glenn Hook wanted to do a little ad for itself. I don't know. I've never really used one. I've just Googled it. Every time I Google it, I see two connections. But as you mentioned, it's not uncommon for watt meters to have three connections because you really need to hook some of them up both parallel and serial. Now, if they're all mechanical, and that kind of goes against the whole idea of the electrical engineer who decided to tell Andy that this is a thermocouple, which is not a mechanical thing, except I guess you could hook it up to a meter that reads a mechanical result. If it was intermittent, wouldn't the same factors affect both the watt meter and the amp meter?
Well, you know, now that I think about it, a thermocouple power meter would tend to average out more. So the idea of a switch vibrating, open and closing with a 50% duty cycle in that black box would average out to zero, reading zero power, and yet the other meters, voltage and current, would be reading on an average those quantities.
Wouldn't it kind of be the other way? With a thermocouple, you could have RF, you could have alternating current, so that the total is zero, but you're shoving, you're jiggling electrons right and left and right and left, and you're increasing the average kinetic energy, which is the way that a thermocouple kind of records what kind of wattage is going through it. So wouldn't it kind of average out for more rather than for less?
Yeah, I'd have to think about that. I think it has something to do with the thermal averaging. That's, I guess, the only comment I could make. Something to do with the thermal averaging.
Okay, but the problem is, in order for it to zero out, you would have to make a case that there's some configuration where the current draws heat from the unit. And I don't think it works that way. Anyone else with any insights, comments? You know, once again, if you want to take a look at it, you just go to your browser and type in roy.ac2gs.com and take a look and say your piece. I tend to think what will probably happen, not into fortune telling, that maybe kind of kick this around for a little bit more, and then we'll pause for next Sunday when everyone's had a better chance to kind of take a look at it, figure out what the heck is going on here. At this point, I'm in a bit of a quandary of how something, it obviously some aspect of how a thermal, again, don't understand the thermal watt meter having three connectors, but just give them a thermal watt meter. If the thermal watt meter and the analog amperage voltages give different end results. You would sort of think that if the watt read by the watt meter are zero, then the voltage, the current that's right next to it would also be zero instead of 0.25 watts. So there's something in the magic box that's affecting one set of meters different than the other meter. And again, because I'm confused, because I don't understand how a thermocouple needs three connections, this is a bigger puzzle for me than if I believe that that watt meter was actually a thermocouple, the way it's drawn.
WB2EAD is a proposal?
Certainly, Ed.
Is it possible that watt meter will not work on DC or at these low voltage and current levels? It's on a quarter of a watt of a 1 volt DC source.
Well, if this was a standard meter-driven watt meter, I would agree with you entirely. If, on the other hand, it truly is a thermocouple, I think inherent in the design of a thermocouple is it functionally gives you no routine square values of things, because it averages out, because it doesn't really care where the electrons are going. It's just the heat produced by the watt.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know. It may end up that we don't come up with any kind of solution given number of Sunday nights. I don't know. Again, one of my questions is the true nature of that watt meter, that it's a three connector. I tell you, I've really tried to Google three connector thermocouple watt meters, and all I can get back is information about three phase power being read by a thermocouple and a watt meter. So I don't understand. It looks like a non-thermocouple technology. It looks like it's basically just a voltmeter and a ammeter cross-wired into the product in watts. But it'll be interesting. But anyone with any other thoughts on this subject before we retire it for tonight, keep in mind that I'll try and bring it up next Sunday, so you clever people out there have a week to ponder this in your head and come up with some very interesting answers.
2EPQ.
Yes.
I was just listening to what's being said, and I'm not exactly sure what you're measuring with the watt meter, but if, let's say, for example, they were putting DC into the watt meter, and internally in the watt meter, let's say there was a 50 ohm resistor or some resistor value, and then after the resistor, there was a capacitor before the watt meter. Then you'd measure zero to everything, but the current would go through the resistor, but but nothing would get to the watt meter.
Okay, but then nothing would also get to the amp meter, right?
Where's the amp meter located?
The amp meter is serially connected between the watt meter and the black box.
Okay, then if there's a 50 ohm resistor inside the black box, or whatever, I didn't figure out what the value would be, but if there's a resistor in the black box going to ground, now you put, let's say, a DC current in there, you're going to measure the current that's flowing into the resistor. But the watt meter may be unaware that anything is there because it's not getting any current going to it. It's probably not the answer, but I can picture a situation where you would read, you know, a current and a voltage going into a black box, and yet nothing going to a meter.
Okay, I guess that's a possibility. It kind of limits thermocouples. I would imagine the whole point of using something like a thermocouple, that this would be kind of DCA want to. And putting a blocking capacitor in line with it to block out the DC, don't see where that would particularly add anything to the value of the thermocouple, but yeah, it certainly is a possibility.
Oh, yeah, as a matter of fact, you know, I've seen watt meters that are thermocouples, but anything that I've seen was used for AC. So I thought, well, maybe you're trying to read DC with an AC watt meter, which, you know, that would be a problem. So I was thinking maybe that, but I don't know enough about if thermocouple wattmeters are actually used to measure.
Okay, the way I see it is probably is useful for a bulb, unless it confuses the issue. I can't imagine why. But so they would block it with a blocking capacitor. But as long as you've had some experience with thermocouple watt meters, have you ever seen a thermocouple watt meter with three wired on a circuit?
Well, no, I didn't, but it's not like I dealt with a lot of thermocouple watt meters. The ones that I saw were just used in microwaves, so they were used to AC and they only had two terminals. Unless, you would think, like you were saying, that if you had three wires, maybe one could be for AC and the other one for the current or some sort of a thing like that. But I don't know why you would use three wires. I really don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think the watt meter to me is a more interesting question, unfortunately, than what's in the load, the black box. But I guess because you really have to come to terms with what that watt meter really is before you can really make sense of the puzzle, at least my little brain there. Anyone else with any kind of comments, want to point something out, want to add something about it before we retire it? Until next week. Yes, Ed.
Someone else said that a watt meter has to multiply the voltage and the current. If you have an inline unit, you have no idea what voltage is operating at. It could be a tenth of a volt or a million volts, and you have no way of knowing that. How it transfers to it varies, really, with no indication.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, any watt meter has to have the ability to measure the voltage and the current. So I must have said, I don't think I've seen too many DC watt meters. I wonder if some stupid like these watt meters
well, I mean, that would be a kind of a disappointing answer to this puzzle, that just the meter mechanism has limitations. Because it probably would depend upon any kind of given watt meter. I'm sure different watt meters have different levels of limitation. So, just to kind of say, well, the black box is just a resistor and the watt meter was a cheap piece of garbage. I don't know. That's not a very satisfying answer to the puzzle, in my opinion.
Here's a stupid question. I don't think I've ever seen a watt meter. The reason you need a watt meter for AC is because the phase gets involved. It's not applicable to DC. So a voltmeter and an ammeter give you everything you need at DC. So I don't think I've ever seen a DC watt meter.
Yes, someone wants to comment?
Yeah, I've seen DC watt meters. I've seen watt meters that will read DC, and they do have three terminals. They have a voltage coil, a current coil, and then usually one of the leads from each of those coils is connected in common, so they have three terminals.
Yeah, I would agree. Again, I Googled these things, and it comes up repeatedly. The way sometimes they describe it is... kind of describes it that way as well. There's four contacts in the device, but one of them is connected to one of the other connectors, sorted out. So it's a three-connector device, which is what the electrical engineer drew, even though, maddeningly, he describes it repeatedly as a thermocouple watt meter.
Well, I think of what this watt meter is doing, measuring current in a thermal basis, but the other terminal, it has a regular voltage coil. Maybe there's some kind of interaction where it uses a heat sensing element to actually measure the current, but the the voltage that the watt meter requires to make its power calculation is done by a coil. But
yeah, I got to look further into that. But I don't know. It's as far as I'm concerned, this puzzle has two puzzles. What's the real story with the watt meter? Is there something weird about how the watt meter is reading whatever signal divided by the 1-volt battery? Is the black box changing, is it an oscillator? Is it a chopper that lifts the signal in some odd way? And are there limitations in the design of the analog of measuring equipment where it perceives all currents to be different and direct? Like, I could make a case, if it's truly thermocouples, then it and thermocouples, as everyone sort of mentioned, is for RF, so it's for alternating current. So if you had some kind of oscillator circuit in the black box, then I could sort of see a case where you probably have the opposite of what's going on here, where the watt meter reads a certain wattage, a non-zero, and the analog amp meter and volt meter are confused, end up with a summing of zero amps or something. But that isn't what the point of this exercise is. It's so that the thermocouple watt meter reads 0 watts, yet the analog ampere volt meter is the proper orientation, 5 amps, 25 volts.
I have a crazy idea.
Please, Ed, share your crazy idea with me.
The black box associates just a cooler that is thermally linked to the thermocouple and refrigerates it so it doesn't freeze.
Oh, that's a real unsatisfying puzzle solution. I would be very pissed if my professor did that to me. Although I have had professors who really did weird things. Once in an anthropology class, we were forced to watch a documentary that was totally in French, not even English subtitles. And when we asked the professor if it would be on the midterm, he said it definitely would, but he would make allowances for the language problem. And so, when it came to questions about the French documentary, he asked it in French.
Question.
Yes?
For the purposes of this quiz, puzzle, what's the spelling of watt meter?
Well, let's see. It's kind of scribbled. If you go to roy.at2gs.com, it says W-A-T-T, then the next line says M-E-T-E-R, and then below it says 0 watt, W-A-T-T-X. Why, you think there's some kind of trick where you misspelled the word watt?
I was thinking it was W-H-A-T. Watt meter, it was a shot.
Yeah, I don't know. You usually, no offense to our engineers out there, they don't usually do wordplay.
Fair enough.
Also, I saw the drawing online, and that was, let's keep that.
Say again, unfortunately, a little bit of noise in the background.
I found the original picture online, and if it had been something like calling watts differently, it would have leaped out at me immediately.
Well, yeah, I guess so. I took a look at it, and at first I didn't quite know what the battery was, because I asked Andy, I said, what does IV mean? Because I guess, because I'm a doctor, I think of 1 volt as IV, probably. So he said, no, it's 1 volt. So that was the only thing I had problems interpreting.
I'd also love to see this 1 volt battery be closest I think of this 1.2 or 1.35 on a professor iPhone.
Well, this is the theoretical world of the classroom where you could have everything be proper single unitary numbers or for half of that. So 1 volt, 1 ohm, No. What can I tell you? I'm sure you could come up with a 1-volt battery by putting the proper amount of electronegative cells juxtapositioned to each other.
It would be a challenge.
Well, but I'm sure you enjoy challenges, Ed.
Well, I guess you're right. By putting together your two series strings of different chemistry as your 1-volt
there's sophisticated ways of making a battery and there's less sophisticated. You just kind of sit there with the electronegativity potential of different metals and do some kind of calculation to get as close to 1 voltage of electronegativity difference as you can and mix and match a couple of interesting anodes and cathodes. Way to go. Sorry, Ed, for some reason, maybe the battery's running low or the position of the antenna is tilted a little bit. I couldn't make out almost any of that.
All right, hold on. I'll call you. I'm back.
Okay, good sound this time.
Take a lead acid cell, that's 2 volts, in series but opposite the 2 AA's, which give you -3 volts. Oh, yeah, the other way, 2 AA's, and then a reverse lead acid cell, it's 3 -2 = 1.
Okay, that's an interesting thing to do. I didn't think of that, but yeah, I guess you can subtract voltages. I don't know how the batteries would deal with that. They would be doing some interesting electrochemical reactions there.
No, they'd be perfectly happy.
That's an interesting question. I think if you drive a battery with a greater potential than it has, it might yell and scream at you.
Well, I have no intention of trying the experiment, but I don't believe so.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to tempt fate. I don't particularly want a battery exploding on me, although, just using some kind of current limiting probably suffice. So I'll put that on my list of things to ponder and then see if I actually want to try something like that out. Probably not with a lead acid, but yeah, it's the same principle. See if it works that way. So very good, Ed. Thank you very much. I don't want to take any more time from Paul with SpaceNet Report. We will try to reintroduce this question next Sunday night after many of our brilliant participants have had time to ponder it. I find that I think best while I'm sleeping. I get up with a fresh new idea, and that happened to be recently. So, maybe it'll come to you in a dream. And I'll pencil it in for next Sunday night. So I want to thank everyone who participated in this segment of the Technical Net. And just remind people very quickly, if you need to reach me via email, it's mailbag@atqga.com. If you need to reach Paul, it's spacenetreport@gmail.com. The link page full of interesting articles, YouTube that we've talked about is, you just type in Roy. .atqgs.com, and always find Mike KT2NJI's wonderful archive of the Technical Net going far back at September 2006. So thanks to everyone for tonight, and now on with the SpaceNet Report with the rest to end.
One sec, Paul.
running a battery backwards is called charging it, over the bulb.
Except if it's already charged, which is called overcharging it.
Yes, so?
Well, some batteries don't like that.
It just goes to heat.
And some batteries don't like that.
Depends. If it's cold outside, they find it cuddly.
Well, enough anthropomorphizing batteries. I think Paul would like to do his basic report.
WBD.
Very good. Whatever you did to your radio, big difference. We were losing you through the night, Ed. You know, it was dropping off, and then you made a big change, and now you sound normal, like from every other week. But and Roy's hanging in there too. He, you know, his signal's still doing good. You know, we hear every word. So, okay, yeah, this WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet, and there's a lot of launches going on. More so now than ever before. You know, just between now and the end of the month, you've got different countries. You've got China. China has sent three people back, another three people up to their space station. Have the Atlas V, the Lucy mission. I'll talk about that in a second. That went up Saturday morning. I got to see that on a replay. Korea now is getting into the act. Well, they launched a satellite years ago, I think around 2013 or so. But now they've developed a new rocket, and they plan on launching the NORI rocket probably this month. See if they can get that into orbit. And they're planning on a larger one as well. And they have reusability in the back of their mind as well. You know, everybody's trying to go that way. You have another Ariane 5 that's going to be launched from French Guiana by the European Space Agency. They're launching a big communication satellite, actually two of them. But it's an important launch because, you know, once they get this off the ground, they know that, and know that everything's good with this launch. NASA has the James Webb Space Telescope right behind it. So if this one fouls up, that could delay James Webb. They were worried about it because they did have two problems within the last year or so on the Ariane 5 rocket. But apparently they've been corrected. So we'll look forward to that. You've got another Falcon 9 Starlink mission broadband. That'll be going up from Vandenberg in California. And another Soyuz Progress mission also up to the International Space Station with cargo. Anyway, back to the Lucy mission. Okay. Got a fan on here for the radio. Lucy mission went off without a hitch in the middle of the night, two nights ago. And that's, you know, I've covered that quite a bit here on the net. That's the one that's going to be going out to the Trojan asteroids. They're the ones that are in front of the orbit of Jupiter and also lagging behind it. You know, by millions of miles, you know, you draw an equilateral triangle between the Sun, Jupiter, and that third point, either in front of the orbit of Jupiter or behind it, you'll wind up with the L4 position in front and L5 position. L meaning Lagrange point. There's five Lagrange points in any three-body system. And once Lucy gets there, they could investigate asteroids that have been sitting in that location since the beginning of the solar system. But to get there, it's going to be a total of 12 years. They're going to go out to the L4 position and investigate half a dozen asteroids. And then, they're not going to go into orbit. Spacecraft will eventually start coming back and swing past Earth. And again, years later, it will pop five locations. So to do all of that, it's going to take 12 years. And of course, they really believe in mission extensions because of that stable orbit between, going past. past Earth going out to the orbit of Jupiter and then passing Earth and going out to the orbit of Jupiter again over and over again, and this could happen for not only hundreds of times, but maybe thousands or even millions of years from now, the spacecraft could still be doing that. I'm sure they'll have extended missions. Instead of 12 years, this thing will turn into a 24-year mission. Running solar panels, big solar panels, recircular ones when they open up. They're built by a company in Germany. They're about 24 feet in diameter. There's two of them. It's going to give them plenty of power when they're near Earth, and probably around 10,000 or more watts when they're near Earth. When they're out near Jupiter, it'll be around 500 watts. But enough to, keep charging the batteries and enough to keep the spacecraft operating with all its test equipment and cameras and transmitters and so forth. That's the story on Lucy. It got off on time. I think the first encounter will be 2025, so three or four years from now. It'll be going past an asteroid called Donald Johansson. They named that asteroid after him, after this guy, Donald Johansson, because he was a paleontologist. He dug up Lucy, the supposed to be the first humanoid. That was the oldest one ever found. I don't know, I think it was 4 million years old or something. I think it was Ethiopia or something. I don't know, I could look that up on Wikipedia. But anyway, they named this asteroid after Donald Johansson because they named that person Lucy, and that gave them the Rosetta Stone of the past, and that's what Lucy is going to do on this mission. It's not an acronym. I know NASA likes acronyms, but Lucy is just Lucy.
WB2EAB.
WB2EAB, go ahead, Ed.
Lucy is Australopithecus afarensis, and she is currently, to my knowledge, residing at the Museum of Natural History in the...
Okay, very good. And was it Ethiopia? Did I have that right?
Can't swear to it, but I believe so.
Okay, very good. She's going to be honored, and so is by the name, and Donald Johansson is being honored by the first asteroid that it's going to pass. Now, that asteroid is not located in the L4, L5. It's a small asteroid in the asteroid belt. When I say small, it's 2.5 miles in diameter. And actually, they're going to use that as a way to check on all the instruments on board Lucy in 2025. So as it goes flying past that asteroid, they'll be making all kinds of tests with the equipment, calibrations, and transmit it back to Earth. And I should have posted the asteroids, the other asteroids that will be passing, or some of them anyway. You can see the relative size. Donald Johansson is like 2.5 miles in diameter. He showed these other asteroids, and they got to be humongous. I mean, the first little asteroid, it looked like a little dot on the paper, and then they showed these massive other asteroids that it will be inspecting years from now. So, hoping to be around to see the results of Lucy in the future.
Another fun fact.
I'm listening to the ID CW on a repeater, so that's why there was a pause. CW always wins. By the way, I love CW. Back to you.
Yeah, a little bit of a fun fact, let me make sure. Yeah. Johansson was listening to the Beatles' number Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds when he discovered the skeleton, and that's why he named it Lucy. And it's the same thing for the launch
of this rocket being named Lucy. It all dates back to Lucy and the guy with diamonds. I would think they would have launched a couple of diamond ships on the rocket to make it literally true.
Maybe they'll have the song playing when this thing finally gets to its destination. You know, I mean, you know, like NASA does with the crews, they always, you know, when they're on a flight, crew members pick the songs that they want to hear. Maybe they'll play Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds when this thing is out near the Jupiter orbit. So to launch, I mean, it was dark. The thing really lit up the sky when it took off on an Atlas V rocket. It went on a 401 configuration, which means the 4 is for a 4-meter diameter bearing, you know, top of the rocket. And then the 0 meant there was no boosters attached. You could attach up to 6 different boosters, solid rocket boosters on the Atlas V rocket. They had none. They didn't need them. And then the 1 is for the second stage. It has one engine for the second stage, an RL-10, which is a liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen rocket. First stage is liquid kerosene, liquid oxygen. So it's a 401 configuration. And, you know, it went good, and it's on its way. So, very good. Let me just move on to a different topic here. This is WS2N. Okay, I talked about the SLS, the Space Launch System, earlier tonight, you know, as the big rocket that NASA is still developing. You know, yeah, they're subbing out a lot of work. They put a lot of seed money into companies like SpaceX and, you know, to develop their rockets. And then they'll actually become a customer. They'll pay them, you know, a couple of billion dollars to fly cargo missions up to the space station or crew missions up to the space station. $4.5 billion or something for Boeing and $2.5 billion for SpaceX. That was the early contracts. I think one had 12 missions, and that was SpaceX, and Boeing had 8. You know, for their first missions. You know, they were gonna get involved with the crew, but they only got with the cargo, but they got involved with crew, so they're paying for that. They have half a dozen contracts, half a dozen missions planned for Boeing, and half a dozen for crew missions for SpaceX. And Northrop Grumman has the contract for, I think they got a $4 billion contract for all their cargo missions, the early cargo missions. Of course, they weren't. This has been bought up by Northrop Grumman. But NASA's still building their own rocket ship called the SLS, Space Launch System, which probably will have the first mission to the moon and then back without a crew early next year. And you know, everything's getting ready at the vehicle assembly building. They're putting together. They've already got the SLS. First stage, second stage all put on, and then all they have to do is put the crew vehicle on top of that with the launch escape system. They'll be ready to go. They'll have to put on two gigantic solid boosters to assist it on takeoff. Once that's all done, we'll be able to see what a mission will be like on Artemis. Artemis is going to be the crew vehicle on top with the service module, which is big as Artemis, right behind it, supplying power and you know, everything that the vehicle needs by the European Space Agency. They have that contract. But, you know, right below the service module that's built by the European Space Agency, there's the Orion stage adapter. So, you know, you need something to connect to connect that part, the service module, to the upper part of the top part of the second stage. And that's called the Orion stage adapter. And naturally, it's quite large. I think it's probably around 26 feet in diameter or so. Where the first stage itself is probably a little over 30 feet in diameter. Anyway, it's a large ring, and around the circumference of the ring, they're going to set up around 13 CubeSats of different sizes. And from what I understand, they are pretty much all now in place, according to that one NASA article. Different companies, including NASA, will have these satellites that will be dispensed as this vehicle is traveling to the moon to go on their own little way and their own projects. I think one is going to go into an orbit similar to what Gateway is going to be in. Another one's going to investigate the moon with some kind of high-tech equipment, instruments on board. And then there's another one that's called the Scout. And, you know, you got to remember this thing's like, you know, maybe the size of a toaster. And it's going to open up. Got these booms that will open up, and you're going to have like 20 by 20 foot Mylar thing that's going to, you know, you're going to have this large Mylar sheet that will pick up the solar wind, send it on its way, and their plans on having this thing someday visit an asteroid. I mean, it's really true, you know, photon, you know, propulsion. You know, Japan has done experiments with photon. We have done experiments with it, and they've proven that it does work. And now this one's going to actually have a job to do, a real mission. They'll send it out to this asteroid, and it'll investigate it. Meanwhile, it's essentially free propulsion to do that. But, you know, NASA's still at it, you know, and looking forward to the first Artemis. And the second Artemis will have a crew. And that will actually fly around the moon the same way this thing is going to do. In other words, this one's like the Pathfinder. It's going to go out, orbit the moon, come back, use this heat shield to land in the Pacific Ocean. Exactly what the crew will do. It's essentially, you're really duplicating the Apollo 8 mission, which essentially did that on 1968, Christmas time, December, when they flew around the moon and came back. So it should be interesting. They won't have a lifeboat on board, like which Apollo 13 really needed. Apollo 13 had the LEM attached, and it was called Aquarius. They needed that to, you know, when the command module failed. This thing won't have that. This thing's going out. It'll be similar to Apollo 8. They didn't have the LEM attached to that either. So if what happened to Apollo 13 happened to Apollo 8, Frank Borman and his crew, Lowell, wouldn't be here, and Anders is the other guy. They wouldn't have had the luxury of going into the LEM, which really saved the day for them. Any questions or comments? WS2N. These private crew missions that have been going up, Virgin Galactic. You have Blue Origin with the New Shepard launching William Shatner a couple of months before, Jeff Bezos himself going up into a suborbital flight. You know, all the stuff is going on. There's two companies, and one just announced recently that they plan on sending people in a closed, pressurized, let's call it capsule. But essentially it's going to be a gondola, and they're going to hang it on the end of a balloon, a helium balloon, probably once it's inflated, it'll be the size of Yankee Stadium. And it'll take a crew of eight, and, well, they say there'll be one pilot on board. So, you know, like nine people in this pressurized vehicle attached to a balloon going up to the stratosphere. And eventually the balloon will, you know, bring them back down again. There's another, and the name of that company, by the way, is Space Perspective. And they plan on charging people, like, I don't know, $50,000 or something to get on board this thing. There's no price, but, you know, that's some of the estimates. And, you know, you get to fly up to the stratosphere, kind of look down at, similar to what you might see from 62 miles up. Well, I think that's a big difference. You know, William Shatner was 62 miles up when he was looking down. These people would be about 20 miles up. But you get to see the curvature of the Earth, and I think it would be pretty cool to do something like that. So they're planning on doing it. And there's another company as well, Worldview, which was the original one that was planning on doing that. Now, this company separated from Worldview, and this one is run by this guy, Tabba McCallum. Tabba McCallum is the husband of Jane Poynter. These two were, they've been together for decades and decades. In the 90s, they were part of the crew that went inside the Biosphere 2 in Arizona and the idea was to spend a couple of years inside there. And everything was supposed to be enclosed, 100% all the food that you ate grew inside this place, and that type of deal. And sure enough, these two eventually got married as the years went on. But and they got involved with space companies that's developing spacesuits. They've sold equipment that is related to the spacesuits, different breathing systems, and so on. So they're in that kind of business. But they've been developing originally the two of them together was developing a system to send somebody, a group of people to the stratosphere. And it was a little different design. Once they got up to the stratosphere, and they got to look down, that design had it where it would disconnect from the balloon and come down on a parasail, float down and eventually land softly on the earth on a parasail. This design doesn't do that. It goes up on a balloon and comes down on a balloon. So we'll have to see what happens. They've been talking about this for years. They've sent up experimental balloons. So we'll see if this is a way around getting to see the curvature of the Earth without subjecting yourself to 4 Gs, on the way up on a rocket ship. SpaceX now has private people going up. I mean, they sent 4 people not to the space station. They sent them to orbit, actually higher than the International Space Station. And they did quite well, from what I understand, the 4 of them. And if you have Netflix, you could see the whole thing from the beginning to the end, how they were picked, how they were trained, their experiences going up, talking about it when they came back. And that's on Netflix. If you put in a countdown, name it one on there, it was five episodes. They had 4 of them, and then the last one was a few weeks later, after the mission. That mission was called Inspiration 4. The idea was to raise money for the hospital, St. Jude's. Their goal was to get over $200 million for that, and I believe they went over $200 million. One guy that paid for the 4 seats also kicked in $100 million for the for that $200 million goal. And then they got plenty of donations, you know, independently, but it was still short. So Elon Musk threw in another $50 million, which I thought was pretty good. So that got them over that $200 million goal for St. Jude. So this is what's going on in the private world and with NASA. Any questions or comments? WS2. Okay, Mars sample return. Missions are now on. I talked about that possibility of not happening. During the past nets of the Perseverance riding around on Mars right now. We have powered rover. One of its goals is to drill into rocks, and the core boring machine, so they actually drill in, and instead of just getting powdered dust out and analyzing it on the rover, they're drilling and breaking off core pieces. The idea is to put them inside these nice, perfectly made field. They look like test tubes, and they put them in that, and all made of titanium, gold. So this rover has to drill the hole, take the piece, put it inside this test tube-like device, and then seal the heck out of it, and have it, a perfect. Yeah, perfect seal where, nothing you can get in, nothing you can get out. For years on end, it's gonna leave it on the surface, different locations. I think they have around 43 test tubes, so, let's say they take 30 of these things back. And to get them back, that required two more missions, two more rockets. One to actually launch a rocket to go all the way back to Mars, back to Jezero crater where this thing is, land in the same place, and have a small rover, much quicker rover, drive off and pick up all these samples and put them in some kind of a canister and bring this canister back to where it landed. And Northrop Grumman is building a solid fueled rocket that would be attached to this lander. So now this rover is going to put this canister back into this rocket, and then it's going to point itself straight up and take off with the canister on board. Now to get back to Earth, that's another story. That's why you need a second launch. So they'll launch another big rocket from Earth, and that rocket will send a spacecraft in orbit around Mars. And it will wait there for maybe years before the mission has really gotten to this point where Northrop Grumman's rocket will eventually get into orbit around Mars. They'll be able to dock with the orbiting spacecraft. And from there, that spacecraft will take it all the way back to Earth orbit and eventually land in Utah Desert. They have an Army training ground out in Utah where they'll land all these, let's say 30 or so test tubes. That could be many, many years from now. Sure will. I mean, the earliest possible next flight to window to Mars is another year and a half. So by the time they got there and did what they had to do, might have to wait for another window to have it come back. Many, many years from now, you'll get a return. And then the scientists will have what they want. They have equipment, massive equipment that they can test everything, 1, 2, 3 here on Earth. Some of the tests that they would do, they wouldn't, the equipment is too big to send that equipment directly to Mars to analyze it. They've done it many, many times before with the other rovers. Different things that they can test, but there's some things they want to test. You need, big equipment that's only found here on Earth. So that's the story on that. Now, because they've now successfully core-bored one of these rocks, and then put it into a test tube, completely sealed, and they have cameras, you know, on board, and they could see it's 100% sealed. Because that's all done, they could proceed with these other two launches, you know, at least the development of those spacecraft that have to do what I just said before. Go to Mars and bring this stuff back. I was in doubt, you know, the first time this thing tried to bore something, and it didn't work out about a month and a half ago. And they thought they put it into this
complete
test tube, and there was nothing there. Apparently, it all turned to powder. But this next try worked quite successfully. You know, they have a picture of the rock, a hole in the rock. They have a picture of the test tube itself. You can see the sample was put in there. So now they're good to go. That means NASA could start paying for two more flights to Mars to just bring. Their goal is to bring the samples back home. And it's going to take so many years. You really wonder if Elon Musk, by that time, will have a spacecraft that, a rocket ship that will be able to get to Mars. Maybe they could do that before NASA ever gets their samples back. Who knows? But that, I mean, that's the way. They are going full blast at SpaceX, that's for sure. Well, we'll see. We'll see as time goes on. This is WS2M. Any questions or comments?
WA2MHL. Name's Bob.
WA2MHL. Go ahead, Bob.
Question. Is there any possibility that a balloon could be used on the planet Mars?
There is a study, and they plan on making a solid structure, like a tank, but very thin, of course, and then pulling a vacuum on it, a real vacuum on it. I mean, that's nothing. And they think that might be able to work, would actually float around. You would think, how could that work, pulling a vacuum? Well, you know, Mars has, we have 14.7 pounds per square inch of pressure here on Earth, you know, walking around. They have the equivalent of 1/100th of that, you know, so it would be like us at 100,000 feet, you know, have something like that. There's like no pressure. With very little pressure on Mars. So a real balloon wouldn't work, but taking the structure and actually pulling a vacuum in it, that thing would actually, they said, that would float around on Mars. You know, it sounds counterintuitive, but there's a study going on with that. But yeah, that's all I've ever heard about that. Now, Venus is different. You know, they definitely plans on releasing balloons in and around Venus, in the atmosphere, not down on the surface, you know. Very good. Back to you, Bob. WA2MHL, WS2M.
That's all I have. Thank you very much, Paul. Very, very interesting.
Okay, very good, yeah. We talked about this vacuum system. Let's call it a vacuum balloon. Here on the net years ago, or I might remember it too. I don't think it was that many years ago that we talked about it. I think it was around the time that the Martian movie came out. So everything was Mars then, one net after the other. There's a couple other things that I'll go by real quick. China. As a company, a private company called Deep Blue, and their goal is to launch rockets and have them, reusable as well. And they have one that looks kind of similar to the early Grasshopper that SpaceX was developing. That's what he called it anyway. It was a test vehicle to test the feasibility of launching a rocket. He used to launch it up, a couple thousand feet and bring it back down with legs. In fact, the legs were permanently open. I remember that. China's right now doing the same thing. I just saw clip from, I guess, from China News, where they showed this thing launched, went up, I think 300 meters. Maybe 100 meters. Maybe it was 300 feet. Anyway, it took off and straight up and eventually came back down. I think it, you know, moved over a little bit, translated a little bit to a different location. But that's a new thing for everybody. Everybody knows that the future of launching rockets has to be reusability to keep the cost down, not only for themselves, but, you know, if you don't, SpaceX will have a monopoly on all of this. So a lot of them are doing it now. You have companies like Blue Origin. They're going to have reusability. Rocket Lab, they launched the Electron rocket with, they've already...